Coming up on Weekend America.
Imagine you're in a marathon. You've trained for months, it's exhausting, but you just have to get to that 26.2 mile mark. Now imagine that once you cross the finish line, you gotta run another 5 miles. And that is politics in Georgia. We visit the Peachtree State and check in on the Senate race that would not die. I'm John Moe. Speaking of death, a farewell to a spunky robot astronaut.
I think of you eking out every bit of science you can manage, literally working yourself to death on our behalf, not for our survival, but for our curiosity.
Rest in peace, Mars Lander. And some of you listeners might like going out to hear live music. Bob likes it more.
The last time I stayed home was Christmas Eve, 1996. Have not missed a show since then. Have been out every night since then.
You're on the VIP list for Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Aspiring boxers are spending this weekend training at a gym in Indianapolis. No big deal there, except that these fighters are also fighting Parkinson's disease, and the ring work is part of their therapy. We'll meet them this hour. We'll also explore the St. Louis music scene with Beatle Bob, a guy who cares more about live music than anyone you will ever meet. Learn what drives him and why so many people find him really annoying. Beatle Bob's going to a show this weekend. How about you? What are you doing this weekend?
I will be judging a speech and debate tournament of high school students.
I am going to a yoga conference.
A friend of mine had suggested we go for a hike on Sunday.
Actually, this weekend is spa day.
I'll be traveling to the Twin Cities to give a solo performance entitled Seolchangu, which is a traditional Korean percussion piece.
This weekend, I'm going to be working the women's basketball game here at the university, selling tickets.
And then I also have a blind date. It should be fun. I'm not sure what we're doing, and I don't even know his name, but I'm looking forward to it.
Good luck with that. Those voices came from Norman, Oklahoma, Portland, Oregon, and Collegeville, Minnesota. The election may seem like old news at this point. It was, gosh, a week and a half ago now. But for some of us, it's still going. Here in Minnesota, it might be a month before we know the outcome in the Senate race between incumbent Norm Coleman and challenger Al Franken. The Alaska Senate race we reported on last week has actually flipped, with challenger Mark Begich now leading incumbent Ted Stevens. Still not final there. But in those states, they're counting existing ballots. In Georgia, they're going to have a whole new vote between Republican incumbent Saxby Chambliss and Democrat Jim Martin. In Georgia, if no candidate gets above 50% the first time out, there's a runoff between the top two on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. We have Jim Galloway on the line. He covers politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, it's the weekend. Why are you working?
What's this weekend concept that you're talking about? I don't understand. I haven't seen one since August.
I could send you some literature on it. Well, set the characters for us in this battle. Who are these guys?
Well, you've got Republican incumbent Saxby Chambliss, who won his seat in 2002 by beating Max Cleland, Democrat, in a pretty brutal campaign. Jim Martin, it was kind of a fill-in Democrat. Democrats were looking for somebody decent. They knew that there was going to be an Obama surge, and they wanted somebody decent at the top of the ticket. They didn't give him much of a chance, and lo and behold, he survived.
Well, on Election Day, there were races all over the country, and now Georgia's the only one that's going to still be actually voting.
Yeah, we've got the ads. You've got the lawyers.
Are you feeling the scrutiny there? Are the candidates feeling the scrutiny?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a combination of scrutiny and fatigue. I mean, every day brings another national group into the race. Last night, a business group. Americans for Job Security, a group that's played in Minnesota. They've dropped close to $1 million in the Atlanta TV market. Freedom's Watch is here. It's turning to be quite a savior for the TV stations.
The whole world is watching you, Georgia. Well, who's lining up behind Chambliss?
Well, Chambliss, it was interesting. John McCain this week chose Atlanta as the spot to make his first kind of post-campaign campaign appearance. So he's been here. And he brought Zell Miller with him, which he was a very much a firebrand. And John Ensign with the NRSC has been here. Things will really start to heat up next week, I think, because after next week you've got Thanksgiving, and then that's when people turn their TVs off and their heads off.
What did McCain have to say when he showed up for Shambliss?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, it was a soft-edged McCain. He let the skinning of the cat to Zell Miller. But it was very soft. He told a few jokes. He told his, you know, cry like a baby joke.
Wake up every 2 hours.
Cry. He rattled off the names of Mo Udall, Bruce Babbitt, and Barry Goldwater. He said Arizona is the one place where mothers tell their kids they can't grow up to be president.
So he did his Jay Leno routine.
Yeah, he did that. But what was most interesting here was that he warned Republicans who just filled the room. I mean, it was a packed house. Georgia has always appreciated a lost cause.
Yeah.
But what he warned them that he was evidence of the new Democratic efficiency at organizing. That they have learned the secret. And they better knuckle down.
Well, so is if McCain's showing up for Shambliss, is Obama showing up for Martin?
Oh, isn't that a big question?
What's the answer?
They're praying, and of course, you know, this Obama, the Obama transition team is just tight-lipped about anything that their boss is doing these days.
We'll have to stay tuned and see how it goes. Jim, you know, don't drink too much coffee. Try to get some sleep, okay?
Someday this eyelid of mine will stop twitching, you know?
Jim Galloway covers politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks, Jim.
Talk to you later.
From Georgia to Texas now, the hurricane shelters on Galveston Island closed this week. People have been living in tents at the shelters since Hurricane Ike hit on September 13th. But the closing of the shelters doesn't mean that everything's back to normal. Far from it. Many displaced people are moving into hotel rooms or crashing with friends. We asked people in Galveston what they needed to get back on their feet.
As far as material things, you know, over time they can be replaced, but what I need is a residence. I need a place to go, and they're having problems placing people and providing housing.
I live in a two-story house, and I found that I had 5 feet, 2 inches of water in my den. When I bought the insurance, thinking my house was covered. Well, they saying that they're not paying for that bottom level, as if I was on a high rise, you know, those houses on stilts.
My house is right here in Bermuda Beach in Galveston, right there. At this point, I need people to get out of the way. I need the government to get out of the way. I need City Hall to get out of the way and have these permits done so that we can come in and rebuild stuff.
I just want some help to get back, you know, maybe approximately where I was at, just a little two-room apartment. My rent was paid, you know, and just go on, I'm hoping. I'm an optimist.
Hurricane victims in need of a place to stay can call FEMA for help. Here's what the FEMA side of that conversation can sound like.
If you want to get on a waiting list, we certainly can put you on there. And as soon as they open a park, we'll be able to have people going in there.
Disasters can bring out the best and worst of government. Weekend America's Michael May went to the heart of the disaster bureaucracy in Austin to find out how things have been going in Ike's wake.
No one wanted to experience another debacle like Katrina or Rita, especially Jack Colley. He runs the Texas Emergency Management Department. Everyone calls him Chief. As hundreds of thousands of people fled the storm in early September, he was three floors below ground in a command center with rows of desks and huge screens.
In this very room you're in, we had our federal partners, we had our local partners, we had our private sector partners, and everybody was focused on that one thing, and that was to be able to save lives.
With FEMA's help, Texas did hundreds of last-minute search and rescue missions. Shelters were set up across the state. And in a bit of Texas ingenuity, Colley brought in huge retailers like Walmart to help out.
When we deliver food, water, ice, we use them. You know, they do it quicker, faster, smarter than anybody because they make profit doing it.
Colley and company succeeded. The response to the disaster wasn't a total disaster, but it's too early to declare mission accomplished. Much too early. Consider this. Texas has only spent one-tenth of the $503 million the feds gave it to rebuild after Hurricane Rita. and that was 3 years ago.
You have that number, Aaron?
In North Austin, FEMA has transformed an old JCPenney building into a makeshift headquarters. There's a major effort underway here to get Hurricane Ike's victims into temporary housing. FEMA employee Bob Alvey gives me a tour of the mammoth facility. It's got a clinic, a travel center, even meditation rooms for stressed-out disaster workers.
Ask the question, because you're going to ask it.
What's the war room?
The war room, it's a misnamed, obviously. But basically what that is a room that was established and staffed to ensure that we're working as rapidly as possible to bring manufactured homes and park models to the victims as quickly as possible.
Actually, the war room's not so badly named. Over the past couple weeks, state senators and county officials have blasted FEMA. They say people are stuck in hotels 50 miles from their homes because the agency hasn't provided trailers, which FEMA has used in the past because you can plop them in a driveway. But Albie Lewis, the deputy federal coordinating officer, says that after Katrina, travel trailers are off limits.
Along came the formaldehyde issue that really gave everybody a kind of a black eye on it.
Or burning eyes, or shortness of breath. Formaldehyde's a noxious chemical. The cheap particle boards in the trailers had it, and people started reporting getting sick in 2005. FEMA initially denied there was a problem, but earlier this year, the CDC confirmed that most trailers had potentially hazardous levels of the chemical. Finally, FEMA switched to mobile homes, which are less toxic, but much more of a pain to set up.
This is not a simple plug into the unit that you can do. I mean, it requires a separate meter. That requires a very close coordination with Entergy and the other.
There's a lot of red tape in setting up a mobile home.
It requires local inspectors.
Still, it's not much of an excuse. Congress even gave the agency $400 million in 2006 to find alternatives. There are now designs for futuristic prefab disaster housing, but a safer travel trailer has proved elusive.
Folks that are out there doing that work.
Now FEMA has to find room for the bigger mobile homes.
Is it realistic to say that after 6 weeks into disaster, we should have 4,000 mobile homes placed with people living in?
Realistic or not, FEMA has clearly felt the heat. The agency is setting up around 60 units a day now. Many of Ike's victims will celebrate the holidays in one, or a hotel, something they can at least pretend is home. Let's hope it doesn't take years to help them get back to their real ones. In Austin, Texas, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Win your party's nomination, you have a chance to be president. Lose, and you apparently have a chance to be Secretary of State. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, the big news of the election was out of the way this week, but the ramifications of the election still make news and promise to make much more news down the road. We're not out of this yet. Here to sort out the events of the week into tidy categories of good news, bad news, and no news is our panel from Reason Magazine, Carrie Howley. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, John.
Stacey Grenrock Woods is an advice columnist for Esquire magazine. Hello, Stacey.
Hi, John.
And we're joined by author and documentary filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. Hey, Eugene.
Hey, good to be here.
Our first topic. There was rampant speculation this week that New York Senator Hillary Clinton, remember her, was being considered for Secretary of State in the Obama administration. No one will confirm or deny it, of course, but she did go to Chicago. She did hold a meeting with Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel. What kind of news is that? Stacey, you want to take this one?
Well, first of all, it's speculation. And second of all, it's what I expected. I'm sure this was the plan all along, don't you think?
What was the plan?
She'd get to be Secretary of State.
In exchange for her dogged persistence in trying to defeat Barack Obama?
Exactly.
I tell you what, you try to crush my candidacy, then I'll hand you the State Department.
I think it's somewhere between no news and bad news. Because I think it's no news in that it's business as usual in Washington. Washington is like some weird, perverse place where you find out later on that people you thought were deep rivals actually still play doubles tennis together in sort of insane pairings. Mm. So the idea that people who were once at war with each other are now on the same side and they work together, it just underscores how much theater we go through as a public watching Washington play out. So that now we are going to see that sort of obvious thing that they're all in bed together and that everyone is kind of doing it for the home team, which in this case is the Democratic Party. But it borders on bad news because I think Barack Obama is promising change, and I'm not sure you're going to get much change out of representatives of an old administration.
Carrie, what do you think?
This is more evidence that those that feared that this would be a radical left administration were pretty confused. It's looking to be about as establishment as it can possibly get. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, John Podesta, Tom Vilsack for Secretary of Agriculture. I don't sense that the revolution is upon us.
But isn't that sort of a product of the way government works? Like, it's not like there's entirely discrete, separated groups of Democrats and Republicans, especially the ones in power. They tend to be kind of on two general teams, don't they?
Absolutely. But I think that there's a romance about Obama that led people to forget that that is how government works. I don't think it's a surprise. As I said, I don't think it's news.
Next topic. It was reported this week that advisors to President-elect Barack Obama were drafting plans to shut down the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Prisoners there under the plan would be either released, tried in criminal court, or tried in a new sort of national security court that has not yet really been completely specified. Is this plan good news, bad news, or no news?
I actually think it's good news. It's one of the things in Barack Obama's offerings so far as a candidate that rubbed me well. And it did so because now that you have created the extraordinary quagmire, moral and otherwise, that the Bush years leave us with, of course, the Guantanamo question is being watched by the world. And so how he handles it, I think, is going to mean a lot. But I think the world is really looking at that carefully and setting up a national security court that actually looks at this as law enforcement rather than the stuff of war would be good for things.
Though I don't get the impression that they plan to act particularly quickly on anything to release the detainees being held without justification on, you know, the day Obama takes office. And there's also this issue of men who have no place to go because their home countries aren't going to let them back in. I think the U.S. is morally obligated to grant them residence here, but I can't imagine Obama taking that leap.
Hmm. So no news?
Well, I think good news. Good news.
Good news. Stacey?
Good news. And I actually do think it will happen right away. I maybe even on his first day. It's symbolic. It'll make everybody happy. Something has to happen.
I do think that doing it has this instant symbolic relevance. But I think it turns out, once you give it some thought, I was listening as we talked about it, that it is more complicated. Like, you talk about giving people residence here who you have just tortured for several years, who now must hate the United States more than they ever dreamt they would when they were either rightfully or wrongfully detained once upon a time. That becomes so complicated so instantly, the dehumanization of this, that it's more like an Alka-Seltzer tablet that we're going to drop in some water if he does it early and then watch it fizz for a period of time where all the complications that this brought with it are going to bear out. This is not as simple as just I do an instant thing and everybody's happy.
Obama is – he's a very institutional thinker, and I just worry that this whole process is going to get so bogged down in bureaucracy that these men are going to be detained for God knows how much longer.
Did you just say bureaucracy?
I think she did, didn't she? Did you mean to say bureaucracy?
You heard it here first.
I think I just coined a new term.
Final topic. The new James Bond film, the oddly titled Quantum of Solace, opens this weekend. It's the latest in the age-old series. This time out, it's heavy in the action, but light on the gadgetry. He doesn't have gadgets. He has hardly any little doohickeys that do special spy things. And he also never says Bond, James Bond. He has said it at one point in the film, but they cut it out in editing. Bond without Bond traditions. Good news, bad news, or no news?
This is bad news. The producers say they dropped the gadgets to make the whole thing look more realistic. I mean, more realistic? Like, what? If Bond were realistic, he'd still be wandering in the desert, like, looking for the terrorists or following up all sorts of bad leads and filling out the appropriate legal paperwork.
And he'd be dead in, like, 1965.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I heard the Quantum of Solace title, and it sounded sort of like a characterization of John McCain's coming years. And not to be mean about it, but as I look at these movies, they sort of portray the new stage we're in all the time. So Bond is sort of unable to be Bond the way it used to be because the world is no longer as sort of gadget wowed as it used to be because we are surrounded by so much technology that's mind-numbing that, you know, sort of like, what are we supposed to be impressed by his gadget when we're watching it at 80 miles an hour on a motorcycle on our iPod with Blu-ray headphones on? It's sort of hard to wow us. So maybe we go the other way and it's caveman Bond.
Stacey, you're in Hollywood. What do you think?
No news, I think, because well, first of all, I was surprised to find out they're still making James Bond movies after Roger Moore, because what's the point?
Thank you.
Agreed.
You know, I'm not at all surprised to find out that they, oh, happened to lose the most important line in editing. Yeah, sure.
Really?
I don't buy, you know. Oh, that, so they claim. I guess he just does everything on his iPhone now, and it's all maybe just a fantasy that's happening in his head or something. I don't know. But, well, like I said, I haven't watched them since Barbara Bach, but they're just as sexy as ever, if you ask me.
Now, the entire news of the week makes sense thanks to the contributions of our panel. Panel, thank you.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stacey Granrock Woods is a columnist for Esquire magazine and author of a memoir, I, California. Carrie Howley is contributing editor to Reason magazine. Eugene Jarecki is a documentary filmmaker and author of The American Way of War.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
An American blasts off for Mars and dies in the name of science. The fact that it was inanimate doesn't make the death of the Phoenix Mars lander any less poignant. Ahead on Weekend America.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. America is in political limbo right at the moment, post-election, pre-inauguration, this gap that we call the transition. We're continuing our series Conversations with America with a look at transition and all the uncertainty and anticipation built into that word. Treasure Williams is a poet and performer based in Memphis. She teaches at Rust College, an historically black college in Holly Springs, Mississippi. For her, the implications of Barack Obama's election are just starting to sink in.
I'm teaching two classes this module, English 131, which is a traditional Composition 1 course, and I am teaching an English course designed around the argumentative rhetorical mode.
All right, what time is it?
Every week we focus on something that's incredibly provocative, and I'm going to ask them if they think Barack Obama would have been elected had he been Muslim.
Okay, 5-minute quick write. Would Obama have been elected if he were Muslim? I'm going to give you a couple more minutes to respond to that, and then we're going to talk about your responses.
I wasn't on board with Barack Obama at first. I was on board with Hillary Clinton, and I could not believe that this country would elect a black man. I just kept thinking that it was the day before November 4th, and that it would always be the day before. I just didn't think we had actually gotten to that day. I didn't think that the first black president, I doubted that this person was born, and if they were born, I thought they were my son Ramsey's age, maybe around 8. I think that this election will define their generation. I think that they will forever be known as the Obama generation, as the kids who were never cognizant of the fact that this was long thought to be an impossibility. When I was in school, I mean, it was common for people to say, you know, he could be the first black president. You might be the first black president. But that was sort of like saying, you know, you might be the first black person to go to Neptune.
They still call it the White House, but that's a temporary condition, too. Can you dig it, CC?
You know, there's a lot of gallows humor in the black community where people kind of laugh to keep from crying. There are black comedians who have these routines where if there was a black president, he'd be cooking barbecue on the lawn and, you know, they'd be listening to Funkadelic.
Richard Pryor, Minister of Education. Stevie Wonder, Secretary of Fine Arts.
And my children's generation will be the first ones who don't get the joke, who actually have seen a black president or two in action.
All right, you can stop wherever you are. Let's hear what you said. If you thought Barack Obama could have been elected if he were Muslim. Hassan?
Yeah, in my opinion, I think he'll still be elected, even if he's a Muslim or a non-believer. It don't matter whatever religion you are. Yes. I can still talk to you. I can still kick it with you.
That's what it should be.
That's how it should be.
Okay, go ahead.
If I told her right now I was an atheist, it shouldn't matter, but it does in this society.
Is this the end of racism? No, unfortunately, it is not. I like to give myself small heart attacks, so sometimes I listen to conservative talk radio. And I don't know why I do it. I guess so I can shout in my car as I'm driving. But I've heard a couple of the conservative talk show radio hosts say, well, excuses are over now. No need for affirmative action now. And I mean, if you have a section of the population that believes it is the rightful owner of progress, or a section of the population that believes that it will be denied progress no matter how deserving it is, then you're losing that human capital that we have in this country. It's our greatest resource. And I think that this affirmation that I felt when I voted for Barack Obama was a similar affirmation that many Caucasian Americans felt, that said, you know, we're human. And at this point, I'm going to step out of my racist historical shadow and vote my heart.
Treasure Williams is a teacher and poet based in Memphis. We've been conducting these conversations with America for a while now. Read some and join the conversation yourself at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, there's some heavy action at the Rocksteady Gym in Indianapolis. A lot of folks punching the bags, flinging left jabs and right hooks, kind of thing that you'd see at most boxing workout gyms. The difference is that the boxers in these weekend classes have Parkinson's disease. It's a neurological disorder that affects the way you move and the control you have over your body. About 1.5 million people in the U.S. have Parkinson's. Reporter Colleen Udies recently met the founder of Rocksteady.
The first time I met Scott Newman was at the Indianapolis City County building. It was about 7 o'clock at night. He had just got done working about a 13-hour workday. He's an intense, smart man. When we were walking to his office, I noticed he was stumbling a little bit in his steps. He came to Indianapolis about 8 years ago to be the city's prosecutor. Scott enjoys the drama and the intensity of the courtroom, and he really thrives in that atmosphere.
And I was delivering an emotional closing argument in a murder trial, standing next to the defendant, throwing a $20 bill at him, which is what the murder was all about, a $20 drug deal. And when I did that, my hand started to tremor in a way that I recognized.
Scott eventually made an appointment with his doctor, and they diagnosed him with Parkinson's disease. He was only 40 when he was diagnosed. His first reaction was not to tell anybody. He thought that it would be seen as a sign of weakness, and he didn't. And as a criminal prosecutor, that's sort of the last thing he wanted.
So I told my secretary, and we arranged things so that I would not be forced to reveal the illness in public. I wouldn't sign things in public because I was having trouble signing my name. And I used voice-activated software, and I had to learn how to use it, but I did it in secret.
Over the next 2 years, his life began to fall apart. His symptoms got worse. He was getting a divorce and living alone in a small apartment. A good friend of his was going through a similar rough spot and saw his unhappiness.
He said, let's go to the gym in the building. He said, I can't take you to a real boxing gym because you're too uncoordinated and embarrassing. But he didn't sugarcoat anything, and we just started to work out.
So Scott's friend taught him how to box, and these workouts were grueling. And many times, Scott wanted to quit, but his friend wouldn't let him. After several weeks of workouts, Scott says he began to feel better.
As I started to show quantum leaps of success with this program and being able to cut down on my meds, we started to wonder whether it couldn't help other people, and we thought we'd give it a try.
Scott found a donated gym space, and with his own money, he opened Rocksteady. It's a place where people with Parkinson's can have free, intense boxing workouts.
Here we go.
People at Rocksteady Gym go through a normal boxing routine, but in this class, no one actually gets hit. Trainer Christy Fulmer leads group stretches. Then she talks about how the class is set up that day.
From the hand pads to the big red rocket, working together, you're going to go for 10-second intervals, you and your partner. One person's doing jumping jacks, the other person is extending their punches.
One of the students, Mary Yeaman, is a petite woman with bifocals on the end of her nose. She wears pink boxing gloves. They look oversized on her small frame.
I love the hand pads. Well, Christy has flat pads on her hands, and then she has hook, jab, or whatever. It's just like boxing against somebody, but without actually hitting them.
What you? Hit it, baby, come on!
Mary was diagnosed with Parkinson's 6 years ago. She's been coming to the Rocksteady boxing class 4 times a week, about a year.
I didn't like boxing at all when I seen it on television, but when I came here, right after my first workout, I fell in love with it because I felt so much better even after the first one.
Mary has tried other workouts, but nothing seemed to help her as much as the boxing class. Scott Newman thinks boxing helps people with Parkinson's because it engages and challenges all parts of their body.
Parkinson's is like a thief in the night, and it steals all the movement that you don't use. So boxing works in every plane imaginable. It's never predictable. You've got to react quickly, and you're horizontal, vertical, up, down, and every which way.
Scott's days are just like anyone else's with Parkinson's. There are some days where he feels fine, and then there are other days where it's, you know, really hard for him to get around. But he's grateful to be back to writing his name again.
Reporter Colleen Udies. Scott Newman is now the director of public safety for the city of Indianapolis and Marion County, Indiana. Thanksgiving is coming up. Turkey, stuffing, those hats with buckles that pilgrims wore. I'm still waiting for someone to explain to me why a hat needs a buckle. Can anybody help me out? Does it get tight? You need to loosen your hat? Anyway, it's a busy time of year for travel, of course. Thanksgiving, all those people trying to get home for the holiday. We've been thinking around here, we've been thinking a lot about that idea of home and all the things that home can mean. We're planning a special edition of Week in America for the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we'd like your stories of home. A nightmare travel tale, perhaps? An adventure or misadventure in the real estate market with a home in transition? Some sort of remodel? Or maybe just a reflection on the idea of home and what that means to you. We'd like to hear your story of home and maybe share it with America. Go to weekendamerica.org. Look for the link on the lower left-hand side of the page. Astronauts on the space shuttle Endeavour are on their way to the International Space Station. It's an interior design mission. They're going to add some bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchenette. But some hearts around NASA are heavy lately. They've experienced a loss. The Phoenix Mars lander stopped sending messages back to Earth. In technical terms, it died. You may have heard of the Phoenix. It was the one that officially found water ice on Mars. Producer Ocean Kalin had a rough time with Phoenix's death this week, so he wrote it a letter.
I know you don't have emotions. I know you're not sad or lonely. I know that you're not wondering why we would let you grow cold to die on your own. I know you're just servos and wire. But still, Phoenix, I'm heartbroken. Now, this heartbreak isn't new. It started back in 1999. The first Mars polar lander was nearing its destination. I was fascinated with the sheer absurdity and hubris of the task, sending something the size of a coffee table hundreds of millions of miles screaming through space to a piece of land just a few miles wide. I took the day off work. I stayed home, glued to the NASA channel. Now, I watched the countdown from hours to minutes to seconds. 3, 2, 1, and then silence. We expected to lose contact with the lander as it entered the Martian atmosphere. We held our breaths, waiting a few excruciating minutes for the lander to send us a message of success, just a ping to let us know that everything was okay. Minutes turned into hours, and nothing came. You know, maybe we'd hear something later that day. When we didn't, we thought maybe tomorrow, or maybe next week. Sometime, somewhere, we'd hear something, right? During the long wait, I wondered why this was affecting me so much. I couldn't really focus on work, I didn't talk with friends. I spent all my time thinking about that little guy up there. Now, I'm not a marshmallow. I like math and science. When the fox catches the rabbit, I get the circle of life thing. But space exploration seems pure to me in a way that little else does. Now, I believe in the Constitution, but I'm skeptical of government. I believe in a higher power, but I'm skeptical of religion. I believe in beauty, but I'm skeptical of art. I think when I find something believable, something pure, something honest, I can't help but love it. And when something I love dies, even if it's just servos and wire, I feel it. Phoenix, you weren't ever going to make us rich. You weren't going to produce any product to sell. You weren't going to give us some new power. All you were doing was gathering data to help answer very small parts of very big questions. You know, who we are? Where did we come from? How does our universe work? You discovered ice on Mars. And all we gain from that is knowing how crazy it is that there's ice on Mars. You died this week, and I'm sad for you, and I'm sad for us. I think of you eking out every bit of science you can manage, your energy dwindling to nothing, literally working yourself to death on our behalf, not for our survival, but for our curiosity. You knew we wondered about the universe, and you knew you had something to add. Please know that you are not gone. Your legacy, your children, are the pieces of data that will forever change how we look at the universe and how we look at ourselves.
Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin. Now, Phoenix wasn't up there alone. Two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, are still tooling around the red planet. Spirit had a rough time this week, but seems to be doing okay for now. We put an incredibly cool video of the Phoenix mission on our website. You've got to go see this thing. It's at weekendamerica.org. Residents of Los Angeles are urged to conserve power as crews fight fires around the San Fernando Valley this weekend. Crews are fighting the fires, but the hot Santa Ana winds are fighting back. Less tension in other parts of the country, though. For weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
The holidays mean decorations, family gatherings, and tragically, fruitcake. Beatrice, Alabama celebrates this rarely ingested dessert during its first fruitcake festival. 63 and sunny to sell, exchange, and auction off fruitcake. Notice there's no mention of eating fruitcake. There's also a fruitcake toss, recommended apparel, a suit of armor. Of course turkeys hate this time of year, but Columbus, Ohio is making things even worse with its turkey trial. Tom Turkey's fate is decided by a jury of people, not turkey peers. I think we all know how this trial ends. Rainy and 40 degrees, which will only add to the gloomy mood of the condemned. And for craft workshops and dessert buffet, which actually sounds pretty fun. Sorry, Tom. Fairies are total jerks. They kidnap babies and make people dance to the point of exhaustion. Phoenix celebrates these mythological pests anyway during its fairy festival. 81 and sunny for face painting, masquerade ball, and avoiding fairies. Also on the schedule, and I'm not kidding here, unicorns. Unicorns would never trick you with fake gold. Stupid fairies. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
An out-of-place haircut, a thoroughly bizarre set of dance moves, and a fixture on the St. Louis music scene for almost 12 years. Beatle Bob, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, music fans in St. Louis have a variety of concert options. Steve Wynn and the Miracle 3 are playing at Off-Broadway. The Alkaline Trio will rock the pageant. You could check out the Rhythm Kings at Beale on Broadway. Chances are, Beatle Bob will be at least one of those shows. If you're not from St. Louis, you probably don't know Beatle Bob. And if you are from St. Louis and you still don't know him, you don't get out much. Producer Adam Allington has our story.
I met Bob Matonis, a.k.a. Beatle Bob, the same way almost everyone does. You're at a concert,
maybe dancing, maybe hanging back, all of a sudden you notice a tall mid-50s man, sporting a mop-top haircut and loud jacket, performing the most awkward yet intense version of the white man dance you've ever seen.
Well, it's a combination of a bunch of 60s dances, like the duck, a little bit of the twist, a little bit of the frog, the locomotion. But my signature move, I get my right leg and I twist it behind my left like a bowling move, like you're bowling. And then I twirl my right hand to the side like you're rolling dice.
To most people, Bob's dance stylings look like an odd collection of jerks, pokes, twists, and random punches. Still, over the years, his trademark shimmy and enthusiasm have made him the stuff of legend among touring musicians. Guitarist Robert Schneider of the band Apples in Stereo says, in a business that breeds pretension, it's heartwarming to see someone respond so honestly to the music.
Like, he'll look at you while you're playing. If you do something cool, he'll point at you, and you're like, you thought that you did something cool, but like, there's Beetle Bob kind of affirming it, it like makes you feel good.
The last time I stayed home was Christmas Eve, 1996. Have not missed a show since then. Have been out every night since then.
And that's no joke. The man hits two or three different concerts per evening. One minute he's there, the next, poof, he's gone. Which is quite a feat because Bob doesn't drive, relying instead on rides from friends or public transport. By most accounts, Bob started turning up around the St. Louis music scene in the 1980s and 90s. Eventually, his colorful eccentricities and punishing concert schedule earned him the reputation of a tastemaker of sorts.
When I first started playing and started getting into the scene, we would actually try to find out where he was going.
Dennis Williams is the drummer for the St. Louis rockabilly band The Trip Daddies.
It was probably about 15 years ago, I played at an old club down on a landing called Kennedy's, and I'd heard about him. He's kind of like a legend. If he shows up at one of your shows, then you're cool, basically.
But if bands are feeling the love from Beetle Bob, the same is often not the case with his fellow concertgoers. Many people find Bob's erratic dancing and jumping up on stage more annoying than endearing, especially if he's at every show you go to. Wade Alberti launched the protest website BeetleBobSitDown.com, where people can vent and share their stories of Bob frustration.
I just don't know what necessarily he brings to a show just besides his presence, and I've heard bands say that, oh, if Beetle Bob shows up at your show, it means it's a good show. I don't necessarily agree with that. In some ways, it also seems like he's just seeking the spotlight.
Like any artist with true dedication to craft, Bob says he can't be bothered with other people's hang-ups.
My whole philosophy is just go out there and have fun. Let it all hang out. Let your hair down. Shake to the beat of your own drummer. And I'm not going to wait for the dance floor to get packed or partially full for me to go out there. If you want to join me, feel free. If you don't, that's fine too. But don't knock the Beetle Bob rock.
But a lot of people do knock the Beetle Bob rock. And not just for the incessant dancing. Bob rarely, if ever, pays to get into shows. And there's multiple stories of him stealing CDs or merchandise. He's actually been banned from several local clubs, but not from the Way Out Club. Owner Bob Putnam says it's people like Beetle Bob that are the glue that keep the St. Louis music scene together.
It can be a band that would never be anything but an opening band. But if Bob's dancing in front of him, he makes them feel like there's something really special. He knows their names, he remembers when he saw them last, and that's important. You know, that's what a lot of people forget, you know. Bob is every band where they realize they're not number one fan.
And these days, it's not just St. Louis clubs where Bob makes his scene. During the summer, you'll often catch him introducing bands at festivals like South by Southwest in Austin or Lollapalooza. But you know, the thing about Beetle Bob that separates him from all the hipsters I've ever known in my life is that he really isn't in control. The tall tales, his monomaniacal intensity on the dance floor, it all seems like something he's compelled to do, rather than a choice. Really, who cares if he gets into shows for free, or if he dances like crazy? Being Beetle Bob is the space where Bob Matonis feels normal, like he belongs. Tell me about some of your favorite shows, the band, what the club was like, what the atmosphere was like.
Well, I think one of my all-time highlights just happened this year at a festival, Bonnaroo. Well, the guy they call the King of Rock and Soul, Mr. Solomon Burke, he saw me backstage. He says, Bob, I just don't want you to introduce me on stage. I want you to sing with me. So in the last song, he invites me out, hands me the microphone. In fact, he leaves the stage and says, you keep going until the band stops. So that was really, I mean, it's a feeling beyond belief.
Do you remember what song it was?
Yeah, Everybody Needs Somebody to Love.
Producer Adam Allington brought us that story from St. Louis. We have photos and a video of Beetle Bob in action with dance moves. I'm watching it now. Oh, my goodness. That's all at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Sasha Aslanian, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Hillary Frank, Desiree Cooper, who's going to a medical poetry reading this weekend. Good luck. Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Chrissy Clark, Michael Mays finishing his first homemade bookshelf this weekend, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim is spending the weekend in L.A. It's her birthday. It's warmer there. Mark Sanchez and Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney, who is trying once more to install a ceiling fan this weekend. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. I'm hosting 8 boys for my son's 8th birthday party. There'll be pizza, cake, chaos, possibly injuries. Wish me luck. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekend has its own schedule, and it definitely has its own soundtrack that moves you along.
When I'm out training on the weekends for triathlons and marathons, and all I have to rely on is that mental drive at some point because my body's going to start to get a little tired, I just play this song.
Join us and hear exactly what the weekend sounds like on Weekend America.